evidence for other trysts. It appeared they'd been having an affair for at least 2 months. He hadn't even bothered to delete the evidence. She glanced at the clock. 10 to 11. He would be at Karen's any moment now. What should she do? Her closest friend, Amber, lived 2 streets away, so Kitty jumped in the car, revving the engine as she raced round there. Amber was breastfeeding her youngest, only 6 weeks old, while her husband played with their 2 toddlers in the garden. Kitty didn't bother with any preamble, simply handing her the phone with Karen's nude photo on the screen. "Can you believe it? Look what Tom's been up to behind my back. The utter bastard!" She expected Amber to be shocked, or perhaps try to think of innocent reasons why he might have such a picture on his phone. Instead, she hesitated a fraction too long, not meeting Kitty's eye, and the penny dropped. "You knew about this?" Amber looked up miserably and handed back the phone.
"I'm so sorry. I thought I persuaded him to knock it on the head without you finding out. I didn't want you to be hurt."
"You knew?" Kitty repeated. She couldn't believe it. This was the woman with whom she shared her innermost secrets. They discussed everything from their most embarrassing sexual experiences to their fake tan disasters, from their career dissatisfactions to their secret celebrity crushes. She was the one who had said the right things after Kitty's parents' deaths, the only person she could bear to discuss them with. Amber's face was a study in guilt.
"Kitty,
she began, but Kitty shook her head, mouth open in astonishment, and held up a hand to stop her. There was nothing to say. Amber had known and hadn't told her. She turned and rushed from the house, knowing that Amber would never catch up with a baby in her arms. She got back in the car and drove home, ignoring the persistent ringing of her phone on the passenger seat. Tom would be back soon, with a false smile and another woman's scent clinging to him. The thought made her stomach heave. She didn't want to be there, couldn't face confronting him and all that would entail. The life she thought she was leading had fallen apart in an instant. Every plan she had made for the future, every dream assumed that Tom would love her forever, and now it was clear he didn't and wouldn't. It felt like a double betrayal that Amber had known and not told her. She had to get out of the marital home, but where could she go that he wouldn't find her? And then it came to her. The documents making her the owner of the cabin on Lake Akanabi had come through just a few days earlier, and the check had cleared in her current account. Why not fly out to see it? It felt like a suitably dramatic gesture in response to such a huge betrayal. She grabbed a suitcase and threw in whatever came to hand. Outdoor clothing, a sleeping bag, some toiletries, a few basic tools, all the paperwork relating to the cabin. Tom would never remember the name of the lake. Now she thought about it. He'd been distracted these last few months. Perhaps he was in love with Karen. Tears pricked her eyes, and she shook herself, before picking up her laptop and mobile phone, leaving Tom's phone in the middle of the kitchen table. She debated leaving a note, but decided against it. Let him work it out for himself. She drove to Heathrow, parked the car in a long-stay car park, then went to the British Airways desk and booked a ticket on a 6 o'clock flight, which would land in New York at 9 o'clock the same evening due to the 5-hour time difference. "You need a return ticket within 90 days if you don't have a visa," the carefully made-up saleswoman explained, beige shellac nails tapping on a keyboard. Kitty ran her finger along the desk calendar and picked a date just before the 90 days would be up. She was paying full price, so she could always change the flight if she decided to come back sooner. In the departure lounge, she used her laptop to book an airport hotel room in which to rest on arrival, then organized a hire car for the next 90 days, which cost an eye-watering sum. By focusing on practicalities, she tried to stop herself thinking that Tom would already be home. He'd probably be wondering why she wasn't there to prepare lunch, unless Amber had called to warn him that Kitty knew his secret. What would he do next? Which friends would he phone? Would he notice that her passport was missing? On the flight, she drank 4 miniature bottles of white wine, ate a reheated dinner, and dozed off in front of the new Ridley Scott movie. The time passed quickly, although she felt nauseous with sleep deprivation, when she queued to get through customs in John F. Kennedy Airport. She conked out in the anonymous hotel room and slept for a few hours, waking as dawn broke outside the hermetically sealed windows. She went to collect her car from the rental agency, typed the zip code of the cabin into the sat-nav, and let the woman's confident voice guide her off Long Island and due north towards the Adirondacks. It was 254 miles, she was told, and would take over 4 hours. Kitty was a confident driver, and she hoped to get there around lunchtime, to give her time to decide in daylight whether the cabin was habitable. The traffic thinned after she left the interstate, and for a while the road skimmed the shores of Great Sacandaga Lake, before heading up into the mountains. It was warm and sunny, and the views were glorious, hills covered in forests like plush green velvet, a flash of blue denoting a lake between the trees, a few white clouds against a bright sky. Her heart wouldn't stop pounding, though. She tried to find a music station on the radio, but the reception was too crackly. She hadn't eaten breakfast, and her stomach growled, but she was pretty sure she would throw up if she ate anything. "You bastard, Tom," she thought from time to time, but mostly she tried to keep her mind blank and focus on the driving.
Chapter 7. Eastern Front, Prussia, January 1915. Postal deliveries to the front line were erratic, but Tatiana wrote so frequently that Dmitri seldom had long to wait between her letters. He thrilled at the sight of her handwriting on the envelope, at the way she always called him Malama Sweetheart, at the faint hint of her scent that he imagined he could detect on the pages, and at her sentiments, which became more affectionate with each exchange. She wrote that Ortepo's snoring kept Olga awake at night, and that she had been playing a game called Ruble with her sisters. She told him of her patients on the wards, of books she had read, and always she told him that she missed him. Dmitri found it easier to overcome his natural reserve and express his feelings in letters than he had done in person, and Tatiana reciprocated his endearments. They became bolder, and he felt he learned more of her character with each letter. He imagined she must seem very private and reserved to those who didn't know her, but to him she wrote with a straightforward honesty that was unprecedented amongst the women of his acquaintance. There were no games, or sulks, or flounces. Was there a chance he might one day be her husband, or did her parents have other suitors in mind for their eldest daughters? He plucked up the courage to ask, and was overwhelmed by her reply. "Malama, sweetheart, you asked about the marriages my parents have considered for Olga and me, and now I think I will make you laugh, because we have endured so much speculation on the subject based on virtually no substance. First of all, I am told that David, the eldest son of the British King George V, is believed to have taken a liking to me when we visited there in August 1909. Of course, I was only 12 and far too young to be aware of it, although I remember dancing with him at a ball on the Standard, while fireworks lit up the sky. He was rather a good dancer, and I recall he was wearing a uniform because he was at Naval College, but I can't remember making conversation. Mama said to me afterwards that she was only 12 when she first met Papa, and that it is possible to know your own mind at that age. I think she was keen that either Olga or I should one day be Queen of England, but nothing came of it. We haven't seen David since then, and I imagine he must be terribly busy with the war. Then, in 1912, I think, the newspapers started reporting that Olga was to be married to Grand Duke Dmitri Pavlovovich, which was news to Olga, who had always found him rather coarse. The rumour persisted for years with absolutely no foundation, much to Olga's annoyance. You must have heard about the marriages with Balkan princes that our parents have been rumoured, erroneously I believe, to be arranging for some time. For a while I corresponded with my cousin George of Battenberg, but never with any intention of marrying him, let me assure you. Olga was asked to consider Prince Karel of Romania, who came to visit us in Livadia last summer, but she does not want to leave Russia when she marries, so we came up with a cunning plan. We both suntanned our faces before they arrived, knowing that in royal circles it is considered paysan. We were polite to Karel, but I think he took the hint because no further meetings have been arranged. Olga and I are agreed on two things, that we only want to marry Russian men, and that we want to marry for love, as our parents did. I can imagine nothing worse than being forced to marry someone I do not like for political reasons, but I'm assured by Mama that that will never be the case, and that we may choose our own husbands. Now I am embarrassed to have told you so much, but you asked, and so here is my answer. I hope you are keeping warm, mon amoureux, and not straying into the way of any more bullets. Do you ever think of me, or is your life too full of plans for defeating the Kaiser's army? Are you comfortable in your bunker at night? Are you getting enough to eat? Is there snow where you are? The snow here is 5 foot deep, and I worry that you may catch cold. Every night as I lie in my cozy bed, I worry about where you are lying, and wish you could hear my thoughts through the frosty night. Did you receive my letter in which I told you of Anna Virabova, Mama's lady-in-waiting, being in a train crash? She is most seriously injured, and we are all terribly concerned, but at least she is conscious and able to eat a little. Mama is nursing her personally. She is so very dear to us, as you are very dear to me. Que Dieu vous garde, Tatiana. It was -5 degrees outside, but Dmitri was flushed as he sat in his bunker reading and rereading this letter by candlelight. The earthen walls glittered with ice, and his breath misted the air. We only want to marry Russian men, and we want to marry for love. Surely it was a hint, perhaps even an invitation. He could imagine her blushes as she wrote, and wished he could kiss those pink cheeks over and over. All of a sudden he yearned for her with a passion that was tantamount to madness. He couldn't bear their separation one moment longer. It was tearing him apart. What was it about her that moved him so? His feelings could not be reduced to logic. Quite simply, he adored the very essence of her. Dmitri felt so sick with longing that it could only be assuaged by writing back to Tatiana straight away and spilling his feelings on paper. Recklessness took hold, and he wrote with the question that was foremost on his mind. Mon ange, your letter has filled me with hope and drives me to write that I wish with all my heart and soul I might one day be the Russian man you choose to marry. I don't have royal blood or a fortune anything like the size of your family's, but I promise I would alternately worship and tease you in exactly the right proportions for the rest of our lives. The possibility that I might have a chance of gaining your parents' approval fires me with renewed determination to survive this grotesque war. My love for you gives me an invisible cloak that bullets and shells cannot penetrate. Please do not tell anyone of this proposal, lest your father think it disrespectful that I have not asked his permission first. But a private understanding between us would make me the happiest man in the world. When the letter was finished, Dmitri lay back on the wooden pallet that served as his bunk, and daydreamed about marrying Tatiana. Maybe the wedding could take place in the Romanovs' private chapel, the grand church at the Winter Palace, with its ostentatious gold stucco and its dome with lunettes picturing the apostles. He imagined his parents and sisters sitting alongside the Tsar and Tsarina. His father was a stern, critical man who believed Dmitri was not rising through the army ranks as rapidly as he should. But surely he would be proud of a son who married a Romanov. His sisters would love to become acquainted with the Grand Duchesses, and undoubtedly the relationship would enhance Valerina's marriage prospects. Dare he send the letter? Dmitri thought about it overnight, and when his feelings were the same the following morning, he rushed to give it to the postal clerk before he could change his mind. As was his habit, he addressed the envelope to Tatiana's maid, Trina, so that the officer who censored the mail would not discover the true object of his affections. He could not risk gossip leaking out. All that day he did not tell anyone, not even his friend Malevich, who had at last returned to the front fully recovered from his wounds. That evening, as they sat around the fire slurping bowls of watery venison stew, his fellow officers teased him for being silent and withdrawn, and Malevich led the ribbing. "I think Cornet Malama has a sweetheart," he joked. "Have you noticed how eagerly he awaits postal deliveries, and how he rushes to his bunk to read any letters in privacy? Pray tell us, Malama, who is the lucky lady?" Dmitri shook his head, grinning. "As if I would tell a bunch of delinquents like you lot." "See how he blushes," another mocked. "He definitely has a secret." "It's the heat of the fire," Dmitri maintained. He wished he could talk about Tatiana. He wanted to tell the world of their love. that any wrong move at this stage could spoil his chances, especially if it spilled into the newspapers. His heart was so full, he scarcely felt the biting cold of the Prussian plain where they were dug in. Huddled in his bedding roll that night, he imagined Tatiana's arms around him, her face against his, as he sank into dream-filled sleep. Chapter 8. The war continued to go badly for the Russians. The Germans introduced the new long-barreled howitzers, which they hauled around on wheeled carriages, and now they could wreak destruction wherever they chose. Massive shells hurtled down without warning. The ground shook, stones rained from the sky, and more bodies had to be buried after each ear-shattering explosion. It took hours of hacking at the frozen earth with a pickaxe to dig a grave, and many bodies were piled in together, without the dignity of solitude in their final resting place. Dmitri spent his days trying to direct their own shelling towards the howitzers, but felt they were making no progress. When he came off duty each evening, he rushed to the postal clerk. A few letters arrived that Tatiana had sent before receiving his. They were charming, but he was going mad waiting for her response to his proposal. When it came, he knew instinctively this was the one. The envelope was of the same type as the others. It was sealed in the same way, but his heart pounded, and he felt sick with nerves as he tore it open.
"Malama, sweetheart, I received your letter of the 28th of January this very morning, and have rushed to my room to write as soon as I could. The answer to your proposal is yes, yes, yes. With all my soul, I wish to be your wife. You should see how I blush to say these words. I know Mama and Papa will agree, since you are so courageous and noble and true. Mama has already told me she admires you, and I know Papa will too. I can't wait for the day when I can call you my husband. If only the war could be over next week, and you could rush home to claim your bride. I fear the waiting will be unbearable."
Dmitri read and reread the paragraph, unable to believe his eyes. Was he misunderstanding it? The underlined yes, yes, yes seemed unequivocal. Was it really true that he might become Tatiana's husband? He read on, giddy with excitement.
"I understand that until then we must keep our engagement secret, but I hope you will not mind that I have confided in Uncle Grigori. Do you know him? The Siberian spiritual leader they call Rasputin, who is a great friend of our family. He saw me sitting pensive by a window and guessed that I was pining for a loved one, so I found myself telling him about you. He asked to see a letter from you because he says that men can judge other men's intentions far better than women. After some hesitation, I produced your proposal letter from the folds of my gown, where I had tucked it to keep it close. He read it, and when he finished, he handed it back, saying, 'He truly loves you, and he is obviously a good man.' I was overjoyed, as you can imagine, and told him how much I want to marry you. I explained that my mother and sisters do not yet know we are in love, although they have met and admired you, and I made him promise to keep our secret. Uncle Grigori closed his eyes and held my hand for several seconds, one finger on my wrist, as if he was feeling for the truth. He has mystical powers, and his predictions always come true. 'Yes, you will marry him,' he said. 'Yet there are dark days ahead.' I suppose he means because of the war. I hope you do not mind me telling him, Malama. Since your letter arrived, I have been bursting with the news that we are to wed. I find it hard not to tell anyone else. But I agree that is how it must be, since you must apply to my father for permission, and I can't see how he might give it till the war is over. Until then, it will be our precious secret, something I can hug to my breast to ease the agony of missing you. I must go to the hospital now, but will write later. When I am writing, I feel close to you, and wish there were more hours in the day so I could write more. Mon amour est pour vous à jamais. Tatiana."
Dmitri stared at the letter, with a tumult of emotions. There was the exhilaration of Tatiana accepting his proposal, but also irritation and alarm that she should have told Rasputin about it. Dmitri had not been introduced to the bearded wild man, but had heard only ill of him. The thought of him touching Tatiana's wrist and reading the intensely private letter made Dmitri wild with jealousy. What if Rasputin told the Tsarina, to whom he was said to be very close? It could utterly spoil his chances of one day being accepted into the family. What had Tatiana been thinking? "What do you make of Grigory Rasputin?" he asked the men that evening as they ate their meagre bowls of stew, accompanied by hunks of rough, gritty bread. "Who is he?" a young officer asked. Malevich replied, "He's a self-seeking charlatan who presents himself as a man of God while spending his time carousing in brothels and bars. He has inveigled his way into the Romanovs' inner circle, and their relationship with such a reprobate does them no favours. I hear the Tsar would banish him to Siberia, but the Tsarina has fallen under his spell and will not hear of it." He shook his head in disbelief. "What do you think he seeks from them?" Dmitri asked sarcastically. "Surely not riches, power, and influence." Malevich snorted. "Of course. It's a very lucrative connection for him." Another joined in. "It's a shame the assassination attempt in May was unsuccessful. I hear he is trying to convert the Tsarina and her daughters to the Klisti sect, who believe that you must sin as much as possible and then ask for forgiveness later. They claim repentance is only genuine for the greatest sinners, a very cynical philosophy, and one that suits Rasputin right down to the ground." "That would certainly account for his many transgressions," Malevich agreed. "Nude swimming, wandering round the palace in his nightshirt, even entering the bedroom of the Grand Duchesses while they lie sleeping. It is not a healthy association. I heard he makes love to every lady he meets, including his own daughter." "Oh, that's vile." Dmitri was disturbed. How could the Tsarina not see through such a man, with his crazy eyes, dishevelled clothing, and disrespectful manner? Back at his tent, in a burst of ill humour, he scribbled off a hasty note to Tatiana. "My very own angel, I wish you had not been so trustful of Rasputin. No doubt he is all smiles and weasel words inside the palace walls, but believe me when I tell you that in the outside world he is known as a scoundrel. I am afraid that if he spreads our secret, it could ruin any chance of us one day being wed. Of course I understand your desire to tell someone of our love. I feel the same way myself. But could you not have whispered it to Ortopo instead? She would have made a better choice of confidant than the wild Siberian, and I expect her response would have been more intelligent. I cannot stop to write more now, but will try to find a moment soon. Your very own, Malama." He sealed the note and hurried to the postal clerk's tent to send it, still feeling discomfited. How could Tatiana not see through such a ruffian? Was she so lacking in judgment? He pondered the question as he lay in bed that night, unable to sleep, and it came to him that her very limited exposure to the outside world must mean she did not have well-tuned instincts about human nature. She was a good creature who saw only good in everyone she met. It would be his role gently to teach her more of the world. As soon as he realized this, he regretted the pompous tone of his note and hoped it would not upset her or even change her opinion of him. He lay awake long into the night, worrying, and as soon as the camp awoke the following morning, he rushed to the postal tent to retrieve his letter, only to find it had already been dispatched. Chapter 9. All day Dmitri agonized over his note. Would Tatiana be hurt that he sounded critical? Might she even fall out of love with him? His turmoil continued till nightfall, when he was distracted by devastating news. The Russian 20th Corps had been surrounded in Augustov Forest by 4 German corps without any Russian commander getting wind of it. For 5 days they had held out under intense gunfire in a snowstorm until all hope was lost. It sounded as though most of the 70,000 men had been killed outright and the remainder taken prisoner. Yet again it had been possible because of lack of information about German troop movements. There were urgent meetings of Russia's commanders, and a counterattack against the right flank of the German front was called for the next day. Too little, too late, Dmitri thought gloomily as he prepared his horse, oiled his pistol, and sharpened his sabre in a biting wind beneath dark grey, snow-heavy clouds. He couldn't bear the thought that he might die the following day, and the last correspondence Tatiana would receive from him would be that curt rebuke, so he sat down to compose another letter, hoping it might overtake the first. "Mon ange, forgive your jealous lover for his temper of last evening. I could not bear to hear of your intimacy with another man, one who is renowned for his promiscuity, no less.
It was agony for me to think of him close to you, reading my most personal letter. Like an impetuous fool, I responded in haste, but now repent and beg you not to love me any less for my outburst. Affairs go badly in our part of the front. It seems we will not be able to defeat the German army with any speed, although I hope we will now restrain them at the border so they cannot sink their boots into Russian mud. If only this war would soon be over, so that I can rush home to your arms. I yearn to hear your pretty voice and look into the depths of your eyes. Forgive me, Angel. Your Malama. He kissed the envelope tenderly before taking it to the postal clerk, although he knew it would pass through many hands before hers. Oh, if only he could deliver it in person. Over the next few weeks, Dmitri's regiment was forced to retreat rapidly as the German and Austro-Hungarian armies combined to push through Poland. It would have been suicide for the Russians to stand and fight because they did not have the artillery and ammunition to rival their opponents. At times, the Germans were so close Dmitri could hear them calling to each other, could smell the smoke of their campfires, could see their sentries shivering in the deep snow. He hoped the conditions would be harder for them, as Russians are used to snow. Sometimes he crept out under cover of the forest to set eyes on the enemy, but he never asked his men to fire at the German lines for fear of those big guns. Until they had such weapons themselves, it would be foolhardy to give away their location. All this time, he heard nothing from Tatiana. Postal deliveries were scarce while the army was on the move, and the severe weather meant supplies did not reach them regularly. They shot deer and picked berries for food, and melted snow for drinking water because the rivers and lakes were covered in impenetrable ice. Dmitri knew his comrades had received no letters from their families and sweethearts, but still he feared the silence must mean Tatiana had changed her opinion of him. Perhaps she had found a new beau at the hospital, with whom she now passed her time. Would she be so fickle as to abandon him after a few months' absence? He couldn't believe it of her. But still, she might be cross about his rebuke over Rasputin. It was entirely his own fault. Winter blew itself out with one last icy storm, and watery sunshine began to thaw the snow. Icicles broke off and hurtled from the treetops like daggers thrown by invisible hands. The ground became boggy with snowmelt, and occasional rabbits, fresh from hibernation, began to grace the camp's cookpots. Meanwhile, the Germans took Warsaw and Krakow, and pushed on towards Lithuania and Belarus. Seemingly nothing could stop them. Privately, Dmitri grew contemptuous of the commanders who could think of nothing to stop this assault, and was not remotely reassured when he heard that Tsar Nicholas intended to take personal command of the army. There was much muttering round the campfire that Nicholas knew nothing of military strategy, and might as well put his young son Alexei in charge for all the good he would do. At last, when over 2 agonizing months had gone by without word from Tatiana, Dmitri received a bundle of letters one evening, all of them from her, by one from his mother. He hurried to his tent and began sorting them into date order before he opened the first one, which was dated February the 12th, just after she must have received his rebuke.
"My dearest Malama, I have read your note and your explanation sent the following day, and of course I can understand why you resent me showing your letter to Rasputin. If our situations were reversed, and you had shown one of my letters to a comrade, I would have been hurt and surprised. However, I assure you that Rasputin has never been anything but respectful to my family and to me personally. I believe Mama and Papa first met him in 1905, and were immediately impressed by his inspiring interpretations of the scriptures. When Prime Minister Stolypin's daughter was injured in that dreadful bombing, he cured her against all the odds simply by laying his hands on her wounds. He now treats Mama for her headaches and sciatica, and helps my little brother Alexei when he suffers from painful joints. There is no doubt in my mind that he has healing powers. One day, when you are back in Sarsko Selo, I will introduce you, and you will see for yourself that he is a force for nothing but good. I hate to disagree with you by letter when we have no immediate prospect of being together. If only we could look into each other's eyes and know that all is well. Believe me when I tell you that my feelings for you have not changed one little bit because of this difference of opinion. I am glad we can speak our minds with each other,
and I'm sure this is a healthy sign for our married life."
The letter finished with many endearments, and Dmitri buried his face in his hands, overcome with emotion that she was still his Tatiana, his beloved. He kissed the paper and clasped his hands in prayer, thanking God for ending his weeks of mental torture. He opened the next letter, then the one after, and read through all in sequence. She wrote of her sadness after the death of a young patient at the hospital. She drew a picture of the special tag, encrusted with tiny jewels set in filigree vines, she had commissioned Fabergé to make for Autopo's collar, then wrote that the little floozy did not deserve it, having got pregnant by another of the palace dogs, provoking quite a scandale. She wrote of the books recommended by her English tutor, Pierre Gilliard, and of all she was learning from Dr. Vera Gedroitz, who flattered her by saying she had a talent for nursing. And as the letters progressed, she became increasingly anxious about Dmitri's welfare, saying she had received no word from him throughout the spring months when it seemed all news from the front was worse than the last.
"Mon chéri, I beg you to send 2 lines telling me you are safe. I'm full of such fear that I find it hard to concentrate on my work. My sisters talk to me, and I realize after several minutes that I have not been listening because all my thoughts are with you in Poland. I will not rest easy until I hear you are safe."
The most recent letter told him that in October she and Olga would be joining their father at Stavka, the army headquarters in Mogilev, where Alexei was visiting the troops. It was her fondest hope that Dmitri might be close enough to ride over for even an hour.
"To see your face and hear your voice would be bliss, even if we cannot be alone together. I will only be assured that you are well when I can see it in your eyes."
Dmitri cursed. Mogilev was several hundred miles south of his current position. He went to ask his commander if there might be some mission that could take him down that way, perhaps delivering a message to the Tsar, but was told that he could not be spared. It was unbearable to think of Tatiana coming comparatively close, yet not be able to see her. Mogilev was not on the front line, but if the Germans made a sudden push forwards, it was not unthinkable that their shells might penetrate so far.
What was Tsar Nicholas thinking?
It proved he had no concept of how strong this German opponent was, or he would not have considered bringing his family to the area. Dmitri tortured himself with images of Tatiana being torn apart by a howitzer shell, and knew he would not sleep easy till she was in St. Petersburg once more.
Chapter 10. Lake Aconabee, New York State, the 20th of July 2016. The morning after her arrival at Lake Aconabee, Kitty drove into the nearby town of Indian Lake to buy tools and provisions. A row of purply red clapboard houses and shops with white eaves and sloping roofs were set along a dusty main street, with skeins of overhead wiring looping from lamppost to lamppost. There were no traffic lights, and she hardly saw another car as she crawled along looking for a hardware store. The road was lined with fast food outlets, camping equipment stores, and adventure sports shops with racks of canoes outside. She drove straight past Lakeside Country Stores first time, and it was only on the way back that she noticed their sign advertised hardware, plumbing, and decorating materials, as well as camping gear. She pulled into the yard and dug out the list she'd scribbled. She needed a battery-powered chainsaw, a drill, woodworking tools, a spade, and a brush and shovel. She also needed a gas cooking stove, an oil lamp, and some cups, plates, and cutlery. The man behind the counter piled up her purchases, obviously delighted to make such a substantial sale. "Do you have a sliding bevel?" she asked, checking against her list. "You sure you need one?" he asked, an eyebrow raised in a manner that indicated he didn't think women knew about such things. "Yes, I have some steps to rebuild, and I need to get the angles right." He shrugged and began searching the shelves. "Just arrived?" "Yesterday." "Your husband with you?" Kitty bristled. Why did men in DIY stores always assume there must be a man behind the scenes? "Nope," she said shortly. He produced a bevel, and she unfastened, then retightened the wing nut, before adding it to her pile. "You've come at the right time," the storekeeper said. "We're nearing the end of bug season. A couple of weeks ago, you would have had to fight your way through swarms of them." I did get a couple of bites last night, she admitted, scratching her neck. Is there anything you recommend?
Yep,
he said, and added a large bottle of insect repellent to the pile. Round here we wear this 24/7, April to October. The chip and pin machine wasn't working, so she had to sign for her purchases. Is there a supermarket nearby? She asked. He directed her to one further down the main street.
You can't miss it.
How about a jeweler's? She fingered the pendant she'd found, which she'd slipped inside her purse. It would be interesting to get it valued.
Lake George is the nearest jewelry store, but my brother-in-law used to work in the trade, and he still keeps a stock of gift items. You'll find him down Bennett Road.
He wrote the name and address for her on the back of his business card.
Say Chad sent you.
Kitty went to the supermarket first and stocked up on the type of tinned foods that could be heated over a camping stove, as well as crackers, cheese, apples, coffee, and a few bottles of wine. The car was full to bursting as she drove down to Bennett Road, which was easy to find as there were hardly any other cross streets off the main road. When she rang the bell, two Great Danes came bounding across the yard, followed by a bearded man in a disconcertingly bright cerise shirt.
Hello, she began. Chad said you used to work in the jewellery trade. I was hoping to get a valuation on a pendant.
She took it from her purse and handed it to him. He had a quick look.
Sure, come inside.
She took a seat at his kitchen table, which was covered in a floral wax tablecloth. The man fetched a jeweler's loop from another room and held the pendant up to the light of the window before giving a low whistle. Kitty waited. He examined the setting of the stones, then turned it over and squinted at the back. There was silence while he concentrated. Then finally, he turned to Kitty.
This is Fabergé. It's one of the most beautiful pieces I've come across.
You're kidding.
Kitty was not a jewelry expert, but Fabergé was probably the world's best-known luxury brand. Her grandfather must have been wealthy, or perhaps it was a family heirloom.
If I'm not mistaken, it's rose gold set with a sapphire, a ruby, and imperial topaz. The engraving on the back is a maker's mark. It's a little worn, but it looks as though the workmaster's initials were H.W.
Can I see?
Kitty peered through the loop, but couldn't make out anything that looked like either Fabergé or H.W.
It's the Cyrillic alphabet, the man told her.
He produced an iPad from a drawer and typed in a password, then looked something up.
As I thought, it's Henrik Wigstrom, who was the head workmaster from 1903 through to 1918.
Was he Russian?
Kitty asked, wondering if Dmitri had brought the object over from Russia with him.
Wigstrom was from Finland, but he worked at the company headquarters in St. Petersburg, under the great Michael Perchin, the most famous Fabergé workmaster.
He glanced up to see if she recognized the name, but she looked blank.
The company was so popular in the late 19th and early 20th centuries that they used independent artisans to make up orders based on sketches supplied to them by Fabergé's designers. You'll have heard of the famous Fabergé eggs.
I think so.
He seemed disappointed by Kitty's ignorance.
They were extraordinary jewel creations that the royal family gave each other for Easter, with hidden surprises inside. Only 65 of them were ever made, and recent prices at auction have reached close to $10 million each.
Oh, my God! Kitty was stunned. For an Easter egg?
The jeweler laughed.
Yeah, well, the one Tsar Nicholas gave to his mother in 1913 was made of platinum and gold. Started with,
he read from his iPad,
1,660 diamonds on the outside and 1,378 in the little basket inside. Not your average Easter gift, I agree, but they were by far the richest family in the world. It was an absolute monarchy for 300 years, and the Russian people were serfs, so all the country's wealth flowed into the family coffers.
Her eyes widened.
Does that mean my pendant is valuable?
It's only small, but I reckon it would fetch several $1,000s at auction. Do you want to sell?
He weighed the object in the palm of his hand.
I still have contacts in the business.
Sorry, no, it's a family piece. I just wondered...
He looked disappointed, so she continued.
Perhaps you could sell me a gold chain to wear it on.
He padded off and came back with a small tray of neck chains. She chose one with fine links that complemented the filigree setting of the stones and paid cash for it.
If you change your mind about selling, you know where I am,
he called after her. As she drove back towards Lake Akanabi, with the pendant resting on her breastbone, Kitty was overcome with curiosity about her great-grandfather. If he could afford a Fabergé jeweled pendant, he must have been rather a good writer. Why had she never heard of him? A mile or so before the track to her cabin, she passed a vacation park with a coffee shop and reversed to have a look. On the sign, it read, Free Wi-Fi. So she parked and went inside with her laptop tucked under her arm.
Hi, can I be cheeky and ask for your Wi-Fi code and some electricity?
She began, explaining that her cabin, a few miles up the road, had no electric hookup.
Be my guest,
the lad serving the coffee said, pointing to a socket where she could charge her laptop. His name was Jeff, he told her, pouring her a latte, and he worked there for the summer, then went back to college in the fall. She explained about her inheritance, and Jeff was amazed when he heard which cabin she was renovating.
I thought that was a goner. You must know what you're doing.
I've never taken on a challenge quite like this, she told him, but I'll work it out as I go along. When her laptop had charged sufficiently, she opened her browser and Googled the name Dmitry Yakovlevich. First of all, she found biographies for a Russian Arctic explorer, a Jewish composer, and a constructivist artist. But none of their dates seemed to fit. She added writer after her search term, and up came a short Wikipedia page about a man who had been born in 1891 in Russia and had written 5 novels. Interminable Love, 1924. Exile, 1927. The Boot That Kicked, 1933. In the Pale Light of Dawn, 1944. And Toward the Sunset, 1947. There was nothing else about him, not even a date of death. Next, she went to the site of a second-hand book dealer and entered Dmitri's name in the search facility. The only book of his in stock was Interminable Love. Kitty ordered a copy, paying for it with her credit card. And Jeff said she could have it delivered to their office, since the local mailman was unlikely to trek down to her cabin. Next she hovered over the icon for opening her email account. It was tempting to click on it and see what mails came in. She had texted her editor in the newspaper to say she'd been called away on family business, so she wasn't expecting any work emails. There would almost certainly be some mails from Tom, either pathetic attempts at self-justification, or perhaps he would be asking for a divorce. The thought made her shudder. She was sure Amber would have been in touch as well, but if she contacted Amber, she would have to discuss Tom's infidelity, and that would mean thinking about it, and she simply did not feel ready. Out there, in the wilderness, on a separate continent, she had already begun to feel like the independent, capable person she used to be before she got married. To get back in touch with Amber and Tom, with anyone from her old life, would make her feel sad and anxious and needy. So many questions would have to be considered. If Tom wanted a divorce, what would happen about money? She couldn't live on the pittance she earned writing theatre reviews, and the money she'd made doing up properties had been swallowed up by the house they lived in now. But her pride wouldn't let her take a penny from Tom. They'd have to sell the house, and she'd need to get a proper job doing God knows what. But if he wanted to save the marriage, would she ever be able to trust him again? Would she be able to make love without thinking about Karen, with the double R? Memories of the naked woman on Tom's phone made Kitty's gut clench, and tears welled up in her eyes. She took her last sip of coffee. Let him wait. Maybe it would give him time to get Karen out of his system. Meanwhile, she would fix up her cabin. When she had woken that morning, she'd gone for an early swim in the shimmering crystal water, listening to the noisy chatter of birds disputing their territory. There was dense green forest, sparkly blue water, and hazy blue sky for as far as the eye could see. The sense of being part of this awe-inspiring landscape brought a kind of clarity in the midst of her emotional turmoil. After one night there, she was already falling in love with Lake Akanabi.
Chapter 11. Eastern Front, Lithuania, the 5th of March, 1916. Time weighed heavy for Dmitri during the winter of 1915 to 1916, and made him yearn for Tatiana more than ever. Both the Russian and German armies had dug into the earth, trying to find shelter from the brutal blizzards that obscured their vision 2 feet ahead and made it impossible to venture out of the trench for fear of accidentally wandering into no man's land. Dmitri still rode out on reconnaissance missions, but it was clear that cavalry would play little part in the next stage of the war, so he also took lessons on how to position the big guns that were just beginning to arrive from Russian armaments factories, guessing that this would be the only way to drive the Germans back from the territories they had captured in Poland, Lithuania, and Belarus. He got through the days by dreaming of the life he and Tatiana would lead together once the war was over. Would they stay in St. Petersburg in a wing of one of the palaces? He would prefer to be in the country. He was more at home in wide open spaces. Still, it didn't feel real. He couldn't allow himself to believe they would be married until her parents had given consent. In truth, they had not known each other long. They'd had less than 3 months together before he came back to the front, and he could sense Tatiana had changed while he was away. Before, she had been light-hearted and almost carefree. Now she had grown up. She said as much in her letters.
"Malama, sweetheart, can you believe it is 15 months since that December day when I waved farewell to you outside the Catherine Palace? I was a mere child in those innocent weeks at the start of the war, with no idea of what I would have to confront. Now I often assist as surgeons amputate men's limbs. I dress stinking gangrenous wounds. I give injections and distribute medicines. I comfort those who are dying. And yesterday I was even able to calm a man who had some kind of fit of terror. He was staring straight ahead, rocking backwards and forwards and uttering a moaning sound that disturbed the other patients. At first I just talked in a low voice, but he didn't seem to hear or see me. Finally I began to sing, upon which he stopped moaning to listen, and at last he fell asleep for the first time since he arrived on our ward. I think my singing must be particularly soporific. The patients give me a little insight into the life you are leading at the front, and I am terrified on your behalf. I know that you are holding the line somewhere in Lithuania, and are not currently in battle, but that shells pound the earth and snipers watch for any careless movement. Malama, I beg you to be extra cautious and avoid any heroics.
Souvenez-vous que vous tenez mon cœur entre vos mains.
Tatiana's endearment still amazed Dmitri after all this time. He was loved by his mother and sisters. Perhaps his father even loved him in his own strict, old-fashioned way. But they were family and were supposed to love him. Tatiana had chosen to love him, and he couldn't understand why. What was special about him? He could list 1,000 reasons why he loved her, but they only made him feel even more unworthy. Her gentle nature, her quiet dignity. He loved the way her eyes sometimes seemed to be gazing from a place deep inside her and focusing somewhere far in the distance, hinting at the intelligence of her inner world. He glowed with pride when she sent him a newspaper clipping describing Olga and her as the White Sisters of the War. As well as nursing, Tatiana told him she headed a committee that helped to provide aid for the refugees who had poured into Russia from German-occupied territories, and she travelled the country inspecting facilities. Dmitri knew she was being modest in her letters when she wrote that she felt shy at committee meetings and wanted to dive under the table. He heard from other soldiers that Tatiana's was by far the most popular of the picture postcards of the Grand Duchesses being sold to help fund the war, and surely that spoke volumes about her achievements as well as her beauty. Her mother, on the other hand, was increasingly criticized in the press. Rumors spread that Rasputin urges Alexandra to broker peace with Germany, ran one headline that reached them at the front, followed by a third government minister sacked by the Tsarina for daring to criticize her close friend. Tsarina will not believe stories of Rasputin's corruption. Perhaps it was inevitable that the populace would be suspicious of Alexandra, as she had been born in Germany and still had family there. Certainly it had been short-sighted of Nicholas to leave her in charge when he went to take command of the troops, allowing the disreputable Siberian to stay by her side. One day, Dmitri overheard a group of soldiers speculating that Alexandra was having an affair with Rasputin. This was treacherous talk, and he could have disciplined them for it, but he knew such sentiments were widespread, and decided to pretend he hadn't heard. He couldn't discipline every soldier who thought that way, although he didn't believe the rumour for one second. Alexandra was too proper, too insistent on recognition of her exalted position to entertain such a scruffy fellow in her bed. She seemed to him rather a cold mother, although Tatiana always sang her praises. He wondered if Alexandra ever read the newspapers. Certainly Tatiana could not, because she seemed oblivious to the criticisms of Rasputin's relationship with her mother. Since their argument, she was cautious when she mentioned him in letters, and there was no more Uncle Grigori. Still, she maintained that Rasputin increased her understanding of God, and Dmitri felt sure that her rather eccentric views on spirits almost certainly came from him. One day she wrote of a woman who came to the hospital to read soldiers' palms.
She was a hearty type, like any farmer's wife, but there was a mysterious look in her eyes when she communed with the spirits. Every soldier she spoke with seemed convinced of her powers, so I asked her to read my palm. She wondered if I had a question to which I sought the answer, so I asked if she could see when I would marry. She held my right hand and pored over it for some time, tracing the lines with the tip of her finger. Then she said that my love line is strong, and I will marry someone I love truly. She hesitated before adding that the line of fate is interrupted, making a sharp turn off to the right, and that this means I will pull off something extraordinary in the future. She would tell me no more, but I am greatly cheered that we will marry, Dmitri, because it must mean you will survive this war.
Dmitri rolled his eyes. So did it mean he could walk unguarded onto the plain separating them from the German front line without being shot? He found it amusing that someone as clever as Tatiana should be taken in by this spiritualist nonsense. He would tease her about it when next they met.
Oh God, I can't wait,
he breathed. On the 7th of March 1916, new orders arrived for Dmitri. He ripped open the envelope and couldn't believe his eyes. Tsar Nicholas ordered him back to St. Petersburg to serve as an equerry at Tsarskoe-Selo. Dmitri was stunned. It was completely unexpected, and he wasn't immediately sure how he felt. Of course, it would be wonderful to be reunited with Tatiana, but he would feel as though he were abandoning his comrades. Instead of firing shells at the Germans, he would be supervising the care of the Tsar's horses. It was a great honour, certainly, but it felt like a soft option. His orders were to leave the day after next, so he just had time to write a quick note to Tatiana and tell her the news. As he scribbled, he wondered how she would feel about his return. She had been a girl when he left, and now she was a woman. Despite her affectionate letters, perhaps their romance had been a childish whim for her. Perhaps when they met again, she would wonder what she had seen in him. His own feelings had not wavered for a second, but she might look at him critically with her newly mature eyes. He caught a train to St. Petersburg and continued the journey to Tsarskoe-Selo in a military truck he had spotted pulling out of the station. It was early evening, and he wondered if Tatiana would be in the hospital with her patients, or at home with her family, or possibly off touring medical facilities in another city. His truck pulled up at the gates of the Alexander Palace, and he presented his credentials to the guards and swung his knapsack over his shoulder to head towards the stables. Suddenly, a slender figure appeared from a palace doorway, all in white like a ghost. She seemed to fly across the distance between them and straight into his arms. Dmitri encircled her and squeezed tight, breathing in her scent before he looked down. Her face was thinner and her cheekbones more pronounced, but otherwise, she was the same Tatiana.
How did you know when I would arrive?
No one knew. He himself hadn't been sure whether he would get a lift that evening, or would have to wait till the following morning.
I've been watching from the window all day,
She seemed short of breath, and he wasn't sure whether it was from the run or because her emotions overwhelmed her.
"Oh, Malama, promise you won't ever leave me again."
Chapter 12. Sarsko Selo, Russia, the 17th of March, 1916. Far from the long separation lessening Tatiana's feelings for Dmitri, if anything, it seemed the reverse was true. When they were together, it felt as if a bewitching aura surrounded them. Colours were more intense, the sun shone brighter, the grey days of winter's final weeks seemed to flash past. Once again, Dmitri's head swirled with the words of the great love poets as he gazed into Tatiana's eyes and listened to the soft tones of her voice. But now he knew more of her personality from the hundreds of letters she had written. Their love felt stronger and more unshakable. He hadn't been back a week before she came running into the stables on her way to the hospital and announced,
"Mama would like to invite you for luncheon tomorrow at noon. Do say you'll come."
He was astonished.
"Your mama has invited me. Whatever for?" "Because I asked her to."
Tatiana grinned impishly.
"Don't worry, she likes you, and you'll get to meet my siblings as well."
Dmitri had been in the company of members of the imperial family on numerous occasions, but only as a member of the guard, never as a guest, and he was nervous about the protocols. He wished he could consult his mother, who was an expert in such matters, but his parents had not yet had a telephone installed at their home. Instead, he had a chat with Anna Virabova, the Tsarina's lady-in-waiting, who assured him that luncheon in these days of wartime was very informal, and that he should just be his amiable self. The following afternoon, Dmitri presented himself at the Alexander Palace, his boots and buckles shiny, his chin clean-shaven, and his hair carefully oiled and combed flat. A butler showed him to the formal reception room, and as the double doors opened, the brightness from the ceiling-high windows reflecting off the mirrors and the lavish gilt decor momentarily blinded him. He blinked and saw Alexandra sitting at a writing desk and her five children on sofas round the fire. Tatiana leapt to her feet to welcome him, then led him around, making the introductions. It seemed they spoke English to each other, and Dmitri had to concentrate to keep up because he did not often use the language.
"You've met Mama, of course, when she awarded your St. George medal."
He bowed to Alexandra, who gave him a cordial nod, then returned to the letter she was writing, but not before Dmitri noticed a strong smell of garlic about her. He wondered what she could have eaten for breakfast. Next, Tatiana led him to her brother, who lay with his feet up on a sofa.
"This is Alexei, who has recently returned from the front line."
It was some years since Dmitri had seen the boy. He was now 13 years old, but looked much younger. And Dmitri was shocked to note the deep purple shadows under his eyes and his general air of frailty. "Did your Imperial Highness see any action?" Dmitri asked. The boy replied with a dejected tone,
"Sadly, I was not allowed anywhere within range of the German guns."
His sisters laughed, and Tatiana remarked,
"I should hope not."
Next, he greeted her older sister, Olga, and Tatiana introduced him to Maria, a slightly plump 16-year-old with merry eyes, and 14-year-old Anastasia, whose waist-length hair still hung loose in the childish fashion rather than being arranged on top of her head.
"Don't ever play a board game with Anastasia,"
Maria warned him, gesturing at a checkerboard and some scattered ivory pieces. It looked as though they had been playing Halma.
"She is an appalling cheat." "There speaks a poor loser,"
Anastasia replied, sticking her tongue out at her sister. Tatiana quickly interrupted to tell Dmitri that the younger girls had begun visiting the hospitals to entertain the soldiers, and that they were already very popular. "I'm sure they are," he smiled as Tatiana beckoned him to sit in an armchair close to her. "Their spirit and beauty would cheer any man." Maria asked him about the retired imperial horses who now lived in stables behind the Alexander Palace, where they were able to enjoy their old age. Alexei wanted to know which of the imperial racehorses Dmitri considered would be the fastest when the Stavrosnum resumed after the war. They all seemed very keen on horses, and Dmitri gave his opinions, conscious that while the girls were competent horsewomen, Alexei had never been allowed on horseback because of his frail joints. A butler announced luncheon, and they seated themselves around a table near the window. There was a bunch of peach-coloured roses in the centre, and Dmitri assumed they must have been